Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. In the words of former FOMC Governor Kevin Warsh, if you've seen one financial crisis, you've seen one financial crisis. The uniqueness of shocks makes this so, and the result is that policymakers need to constantly innovate in their response to episodes of heightened uncertainty. Now a visiting scholar at the Hoover Institute, Kevin shares with me his perspective on the pandemic of 2020, evaluating the mix of forces that brought the VIX to a new all-time high, even as the Treasury market nearly imploded. Kevin's experience on the FOMC during the global financial crisis has taught him lessons about the institutional realities of crisis firefighting. In the moment, a central bank may be left with few good options and be forced to use controversial measures to restore market functioning. In Kevin's rendering, what's more important is the set of reforms pursued by a central bank between crisis events that matters most, and here, the Fed may not have done enough in the decade between the GFC and the pandemic. We end on an optimistic note, with Kevin expressing confidence that the U.S. will get it right and the dynamism that characterizes the economy will again emerge. I hope you enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange as much as I did, my conversation with Kevin Warsh. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Kevin Warsh. He is the Shepherd Family Distinguished Visiting Fellow in Economics at the Hoover Institution, also a lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, an advisor to Stanley Druckenmiller's Duquesne Family Office, and of course, was on the firefighting committee with Bernanke at the Board of Governors of the Fed from 2006 to 2011. Kevin, thanks so much for taking the time and joining us today.
Hey, thanks very much, Dean. Happy to join you. Look forward to our discussion.
Well, last when you and I saw each other, I was in your office, I think it was January, and I was pitching you on a charity event that I was going to be hosting. You were kind enough to agree to it. We, of course, did not pull it off. A lot has happened between January and now, some chaos in markets, chaos in the economy. I figured we'd start with 2020, the crisis of 2020. What an interesting time for us. I'm wondering if you could just share your perspective as a policymaker, as someone who's studied economics and markets for years. What was your take on the volatility that beset the markets so quickly in March? Was it just how unique the shutdown was? What's your big picture take on the March volatility?
I think obviously the pandemic itself was unexpected by markets, but in some sense, I think the surge in volatility should be expected after a long period where volatility was low, both measured and unmeasured. The policy responses between the last crisis and this crisis were quick, as if to mute volatility, as if to make it go away. So whenever there's a, quote, surprise after a long period of relative calm, it can lead to outsized effects in financial markets, outsized effects in the real economy, and outsized effects by policymakers. I think when the history, years from now, when we look back on the pandemic, I suspect that that first draft of history will look at the pre-crisis period as setting the baseline for setting the environment whereby the shock was bigger than it would have otherwise been. And if we go to the darkest days in financial markets in March at some point, when we see that the securities that you and I follow quite a bit, Treasury securities, other things that are deep and liquid, certainly the holders of those securities had come to expect the world would forever be benign. And when that turned out not to be the case, the fall off in market functioning, the widening of spreads, in some sense, then cause the participants in those markets to demand that the Federal Reserve come to their rescue yet again. So it's just a bit of an impression, I think, of the surge in volatility. Half or some portion of it happened because the pandemic, but the balance of it was, I think, a function broadly of policy making in the pre-crisis era.
One of the things that has been debated recently, just again, running with your commentary on Treasury markets in the crisis, in some ways, the first market to really start to become untethered was the risk-free market. And so there's debate. The BIS has put some work out on essentially saying that levered players in the hedge fund industry were a big part of the amplification of those risks. There's been pushback on that from other organizations that have said that institutional incentivization structures were a big part of it as well in terms of the setup, perhaps the set of rules in place in the period coming into the crisis. What's your take? You've always been someone that's steeped in policy, but also really looks at the overlay of policy on markets. What is your take, just specific to the Treasury market, on the setup versus the reality of the shutdown?
Yeah, so I'll avoid proper nouns mostly because I'm not sure what players did what, and I suspect there'll be some blue ribbon commission that will want to sort of cast blame in different directions. But I guess I'd broadly say, as a policy matter, the objective function of policymakers, including central banks, between the wars, between the crisis in which I was in Washington and this one in which I find myself in the bleachers, bred a lot of expectation that the risk-free rates would be both risk-free and highly liquid in all states of the world. And so we shouldn't be surprised that market participants, a decade into a rather advanced financial cycle, come to expect that, come to think that that's second nature. And so any volatility would naturally be amplified because there wouldn't be participants as active in that market betting on that volatility. So risk is highest, as we used to say, when measures of risk are lowest. And if you believe what I believe, and I think you believe, which is everything is priced off of this risk-free rate, then you would think that it would have been among the key items in a reform agenda between the wars to ensure not just that the Treasury market was functioning, but that it would be resilient. And so I think there will be a lot of lessons learned about market structure. But in some sense, I don't blame so much market participants because there's not much I would be able to do about it. I ask questions, however, of policymakers who devise a system where central bankers end up being large purchasers in benign times and then have to be still larger purchasers when times get tough. It strikes me in political science, we call that behavior path dependency. The longer you go down the path of QEs, the longer you go down the path of being major participants in the markets, the more you can crowd out some other market participants that might be useful when times get tough. And so I'm not surprised when the turmoil got turned ugly that the central bank in the U.S. and some other players felt obligated to go still bigger and bigger and cross more lines than they had crossed before and that we, frankly, had even countenanced crossing a decade ago.
The response to the financial market sell-off was overwhelming, even by Fed standards. I think most participants in securities markets were, I'm not sure if the right word is impressed, but certainly took note of the size and scope, and then the creep into assets that maybe previously sat on the other side of the red line in terms of private credit risk and so forth. What should we take away from this sort of observation that it feels like at every successive crisis of major import, the Fed is doing more and more? If you go back to the 87 crash, it was Fed ease and a couple of statements they made. LTCM, they brokered a big trade with banks. Of course, you know more than anyone about the GFC itself. And now here in 2020, an overwhelming amount of Treasury purchases wading into private markets of corporate bonds. What's the big picture from your perspective? What do you take away from that mission creep from the Fed's perspective?
It's a dangerous set of developments unless you believe that the central bank should be the ultimate market maker in virtually every security on our Bloomberg terminals. So if you believe what I believe, which is probably not very attractive to some academics and policymakers on both the left and right, which is the central bank at its core, at least this version of the Federal Reserve at its core, our third experiment with a central bank, is basically number one job is to deal with systemic shocks. Of course, in normal times, there's much that can be done to try to bring employment back to objective, try to ensure price stability. But what was the original rationale of the central bank? The original rationale was to respond to unanticipated shocks. So what you want to do is you want to go into those shocks with a lot of power, with a lot of ammunition. And you want that ammunition to be as helpful as possible to the real side of the economy. And I think of interest rates being most effective to help the real economy as you cross more and more red lines, whether it be QE for treasuries and agencies, now to QE for high-yield bonds, it certainly has a large effect on financial markets. But if ultimately the mission is to try to bring the real economy back to its objectives, then it gets harder and harder to help the real economy. So we end up, I think, after a couple of decades where policymakers would talk about Japan as in a discussion on policy with a bit of a ad hominem critique, oh, the Japanese haven't brought their inflation up to objective, the Japanese central bank hasn't done what they should do, after being a bit of the punchline for how policymakers should be for a few decades, now it appears to me that on the current trajectory, the Bank of Japan is actually going to be the model. You see the Bank of Japan acting in hand with the Ministry of Finance. That does appear to be something close to the model where other major Western central banks are going. You also see the Bank of Japan having crossed red lines in prior periods, now owning a double-digit percentage of the largest Japanese equities. So if there were a double-dip recession here in the U.S. or asset prices were to fall very significantly from their trading peaks, you have to ask yourself the question, using 13-3 authorities and the rest, what would it take for the central bank to be buying equities in the U.S.? It would get chuckles a year ago. It gets fewer chuckles today, and I suspect it's a subject that, in the darkest days of the crisis, my former colleagues at the Federal Reserve had to give some thought to as they've crossed a whole bunch of other lines.
And is the view on that just in terms of potentially going further and further and doing what some other central banks have already done in terms of actually buying equities, is the view that why should we give back some of the progress we've made on the wealth channel? What is the kind of motivating view for a central banker that's willing to do that? And then how do they look at the trade-offs? Certainly, folks, you want to think that that's not sound policy, but it seems like it's coming up more. Certainly with corporate bonds, it has.
So I've always tried to steer clear of trying to judge other people's intentions. So I think the intentions of almost everybody I know in the central bank community are right. Public policy oriented people that are trying to strengthen the real economy in the United States, that are trying to achieve congressionally given objectives. So I have no issue with the good faith and the intentions of this crop of policymakers or almost any crop I've seen in my professional lifetime. But I think the question isn't about their intentions. The reason why they effectively had felt compelled to backstop the municipal market, the high yield markets, is they felt they had no other choice. And given, what did a former Secretary of Defense say, Dean, you go to war with the army you've got, not the army you want. And so when you feel as though you have no choice, you don't really have a problem. You just do it. And you say, well, we'll reform the system later. We'll make sure this never happens again. So I think you only cross these lines when you feel as though you don't have much of a choice. I don't think that policymakers in Washington today at the Federal Reserve wanted to be in the high-yield markets, wanted to backstop the municipal markets, but they found themselves there because they looked around and almost all their other policy tools were exhausted. So I think that's how you find yourself in the stock market. I'd say on the cost side, as you ask, Dean, the question is, what are the costs? I happen to think the costs are very large. The farther the central bank and the U.S. government wanders into new asset classes, the more they end up setting prices instead of taking prices. And this American experiment in American-style capitalism doesn't work as well if the U.S. owns a significant share of equities or anything else. It can run something closer to industrial policy. So I don't think they're going to end up buying stocks because they want to, but they might have a different view of the costs and risks than someone like I do. And maybe just as a final point, Dean, again, I think the question really goes back to not what did you do on the front edge of the Great Crisis, what did you do in the decade or so between these periods to reestablish the toolkit, to reestablish a set of ex-ante provisions such that you can deal with shocks that happened. And what worries me is that just like in the crisis in which I'm more familiar, the economics profession, I think, broadly believed in the great moderation, believed that really bad stuff will never happen again. There could be garden variety recessions and garden variety expansions, but the tools going into the crisis of 08 were sufficiently refined that we wouldn't have to really worry about tail risks. But I think that's a lesson that should have been internalized in that post-crisis era. And now if I think about the early innings of this crisis era, I wonder whether or not they're taking up more seriously real reforms. The reform agenda between, call it 2010 and 2020, I don't think history is going to think that that proven sufficient. Just give one example, the bank stress tests. We did, I think, a pretty good job in innovating this idea of stress tests in the last crisis, make sure we understood what was in these banks. They weren't perfect, but it was an attempt to compare institutions, both for market discipline, but also for regulatory discipline. But as those stress tests were used year after year between 2010 and 2020, I think they more than exhausted their informational content. They lost much of their discipline. And so the Fed ran a stress test before this pandemic with a set of really dark scenarios, not unlike the economic shock that happened with shocks to employment, shocks to output, and the rest. And everyone passed. When we actually ran the real life experiment, the only reason these institutions largely passed is because of extraordinary Federal Reserve and fiscal support. And so I think that says that we should innovate more seriously, reform more seriously and more structurally when we get to the other side of this. And so the criticism broadly isn't what do you do when you're in a deep, dark shock? What do you do when you're in a crisis? Reasonable people can disagree with choices that are made by the Powell Fed and the Bernanke Fed. I think the harder question and the real burden for policymakers, monetary and fiscal, is what do you do in the periods between them so that you have optionality, so that there are reasonable alternatives? And again, with the goal of the principal goal, not what do we do to bring financial markets back. The principal goal should be what do we do to help the real economy? And if we are able to do that, then financial markets can take care of themselves.
The crisis of 2008 and the crisis of 2020 are so extremely different. They both brought about new all-time highs in the VIX, which ironically are right next to each other, about 82. So remarkable level of volatility, but one is really more about asset price contagion and the remedies that you and the Bernanke Fed were a part of in trying to resuscitate the patient was really straight to the market side. Here you have something, and I was listening to a recent interview that you did, where the patient is really the real economy, and the set of tools that the Fed is using don't really get right to the real economy. They might get to it indirectly, but as you've said, they're very influential on asset prices themselves. How should we think about the way forward in terms of how to buy time and then how to successfully get the economy back on track? What's the right mix of, in your estimation, monetary policy, fiscal policy? How can they work together?
It's a great question. So let me handle it two ways. First, a comparison of these crises, and then secondly, what mix of policies to do. First, I've now repeated, I think, in op-ed separated only by about a dozen years, the line, if you've seen one financial crisis, you've seen one financial crisis. And I think these are more different than they are similar. In some sense, the 08 crisis was a shock, principally to financial institutions and financial markets. The principal job, in my view, was how do you mitigate the harm that could be done from that shock, mitigate the harm that would otherwise flow to the real economy. And so when you design QE1, as we did in the dark days of that crisis, it was to try to help the financial market functioning come back and make sure it didn't affect Main Street. When you fast forward to the 2020 shock, it hit the real economy first, and financial markets were reacting in some sense to that. To the extent there was a financial market overreaction, I think we've covered it. That was in part because of the financial conditions and expectations set forward by policymakers. But this is principally a Main Street shock, and so as a result, we shouldn't be surprised that if you use the 2008 and 2009 set of medicines on the 2020 shock, it's not medicine that's overly effective. So you need to start perhaps in the darkest days of the crisis by cutting and pasting from the last crisis. But you can't leave it there because this is more about what's happening on Main Street. So again, what surprises me maybe most now, say 6 or 7 months from the darkest days of this crisis, are a few things. One, policymakers of all stripes, of all parties, of all institutions are taking credit for the rather remarkable move from the bottom in the real economy, but I would give the most credit by far to the micro foundations of the real economy. The willingness of small businesses and households to figure out workarounds, to get back to work, to figure out how to manage all of their challenges and obligations, how to get the kids back to school and still show up at work, how to do work remotely, how to put together a living if you've lost your job. So the overwhelming credit, much to the chagrin of official Washington, I don't think goes to Washington policymakers. It goes to the people on the front lines every day. So they deserve most of the credit. I think to the extent Washington can help, and I believe Washington can, I will say I'm surprised most that the broad fiscal and monetary support hasn't been much more Main Street oriented than Wall Street oriented. I understand why. I don't think it's because policymakers are trying to help Wall Street per se, but the 2008-2009 foundations were much more directed at Wall Street for reasons that were understandable. And the flow through of that to Main Street strikes me as rather attenuated. So imagine a simple rule, which is rough justice. Every dollar that's going first to the financial markets should be matched by a dollar going to Main Street, to the real economy. Surely we can do better than that rough justice, but it looks to me as though we're doing somewhat worse than that rough justice. And so I'm a little bit surprised that there hasn't been more directed aid towards Main Street rather than going through a set of governmental programs that only help Main Street derivatively.
And there is the Main Street Lending Program, and it's one of the few programs that's actually not been successful that the Fed has effectively launched this year, or in addition, the government. What do you think are the main frictions there in terms of getting that to have greater take-up, or is there a different approach that the Fed and government should be contemplating?
It's difficult to do much now, but if you go back, I put something in the Wall Street Journal, I don't know, it must have been in the middle of March, I think in the end of February, I wrote that they better start cutting rates and fast, and a few weeks later they would, and they ended up doing it. And a few weeks later, I sort of tried to make the point probably more articulately in writing than I did to your podcast listeners that the Main Street really needs to be the focus. So I wrote up a program, which they certainly named their program better than I named mine. Theirs was called the Main Street Credit Facility. I think mine was some horrible name. I think the Government Credit Support Program or some such thing. But I think the designed features of the thing that I had thought about and recommended would have gone through the banking system. So rather than imposing a new set of underwriting standards, which is in this Main Street Credit Facility, a new set of processes, a new set of underwriting standards, the underwriting standard that I had in mind for the darkest days of the crisis are the banks should use their own existing underwriting standards. The Federal Reserve and other bank regulators would oversee this by just ensuring the bank followed their existing lending standards. They didn't break from them. And the principle was, if the business, small business, would have received a loan as of February 1st, but would no longer have been given the loan in the dark days of the pandemic in the spring, the bank would provide that loan on those terms as if it was the day before the big shock hit. And in the event that that loan turns bad, which certainly could happen during this period of time, then the role of government there would be to backstop that loan in the crisis so the bank wouldn't take the first loss, the government would. And so there's a range of design features that I think are better than the Main Street facility, one of which is to use the architecture, systems, processes, and relationships between the banks and their normal customer base. And the way to mitigate against bad faith or ill-doing would just be to have the regulators ensure that the banks followed their own underwriting standards. So that's a big design principle. I think the other design principle that I had in mind then that I still think would work then and would work now, which is we describe many of these bills in Congress as stimulus bills. I don't think about them that way. I don't think that's the right measuring piece. I think the better way to think about it, especially in the dark days of the crisis, but even now, is we are a rich and generous country. The crisis happened perhaps through the fault of people, but certainly not people on Main Street. And so for small loans to small businesses, a grant from the government, cash, a check in the mail for up to a certain amount of money to sort of bridge them from the pandemic to a brighter future with, frankly, very few strings attached, unlike programs that were part of this, were part of these stimulus bills where it says you get the money as a grant, but you have to do X, Y, and Z, and if you don't do it, it'll turn into a loan. I think all that administrative noise lowers efficacy, lowers the support for these programs, and can slow the response of it. So I think for a certain class of what we would have thought of as loans, plain, simple grants, and again, I would use the banking system as the transmission mechanism rather than other government agencies, because I do think the banking system generally works well in that. We have 3,000 or 4,000 community banks that are embedded in their communities. That's a good way to handle some bit of the problem. And on the Main Street Credit Facility for larger companies, companies that need more support, again, I think it's best to use the existing muscle memory that is embedded in the system rather than design a new one on the fly. I think those are among the reasons why this Main Street facility has been rather poorly received. There's obviously an uncomfortable discussion, negotiation that has to happen between the Congress and the Treasury, and the Treasury and the Fed. But I would have thought that all the interests should be aligned of trying to provide the kind of support that was necessary instead of asking a whole range of bureaucratic questions about, if you do this, then we'll require Y. That strikes me as reasonably counterproductive when you get hit by a shock.
In the aftermath of this, so 6 months into it, what's your take on just the broad statistics on credit availability? It started to become a little more constricted, but I haven't seen anything that shows just, again, broadly the system is in a, quote, credit crunch. But what do you see on that front?
So if you weren't reading the news and following acts in Washington, and all you were subjected to were official government data, or all you could see, for example, were the checking accounts of households and businesses, you would think that there is an economic boom. I think if you look at the four quarters of economic growth ending in the second quarter of 2020, that looks like the largest increase in household disposable income that we've probably seen since the 1940s. So if you only judge that, you'd say, well, there must be an incredible economic boom that's happening. If you look, I suspect, at what will turn out to be the four quarters of income to households in 2020, and again, here we're using aggregate statistics, so the aggregate can mask some underlying real hardship that's happening across the economy. But if you use the four quarters of 2020, I suspect this year will look like the largest increase in household income since maybe the year 2000. So what that means is there have been such large transfer payments, and for purposes of your question of credit availability, of financial conditions, some of the loosest financial conditions that we've seen in the modern history of the world, you would think, well, everything must be swell. And so you could extrapolate that and say one of two things, both of which I think are wrong. One is, boy, I'm glad that's over. Everything is great. We have nothing to worry about. This will be a V-shaped recovery. Or you could make, I think, the other incorrect conclusion, and you'd say the only way for this economy to get back to the kind of growth rates we would want of the U.S. and the equivalent to post-war economy is we got to keep all this, these financial conditions this loose and keep these transfer payments this large. I think those are both logical conclusions, but I think they're both wrong. I think the simplest way to put it is that household income that is earned is treated differently by households and treated differently by businesses than household income that is gifted or granted or provided by our government. So we shouldn't either expect that this will continue forever, nor should we think that this stuff is free. It's not free for the Federal Reserve to be providing this or for Congress. You don't have to be a total fiscal hawk to believe there is a budget constraint on our government, a budget constraint on households and businesses, and I think it's dangerous for us to suggest there's not. So I guess that the short answer to, I think, a very good question, we want durable engines of growth to come back to the economy. Those durable engines are understandably impeded when there's a shock. And we should also understand that it is both natural for a rich and powerful country like ours to provide support, especially the least well-off among us. But that cannot be a permanent feature of our economy, because if so, instead of the growth rates that we've come to expect and I think are realistic in the 21st century will end up with less dynamism, more static economy, which does no good to virtually any household or business.
I'm thinking back to the period post the Eurozone sovereign crisis, call it 2012, and the remedy, you'll recall at that time, was austerity. This was the Reinhardt and Rogoff, this time is different, and this study of these periods of increase in government debt and what they meant for future growth. And the idea was belt tightening to get everything under control. It seems like we've done a 180, at least in the discussion amongst the folks, perhaps in policymaking and academia. And it's almost as if it's politicized. It's difficult to actually talk about budget constraints these days, just given that there is a lot of hardship on Main Street. But as you note, it's not free. I'm curious if you can just walk us through the evolution of your own thinking about government debt. We're just awash in it at the lowest rates of all time. How has your framework on this evolved over the years?
So not nearly as much as most of my colleagues who are policymakers in the profession. I continue to think there's a budget constraint. I continue to believe that the U.S. is in all likelihood, even today, to be the last one standing, meaning I'd rather have our risks and opportunities. I'd rather have the dollar as the world's reserve currency. I'd rather have, even now, our deficits and debt and entitlement problems than virtually any other large major economy in the world. And so there could well be a sovereign shock, a sovereign risk, but it will be to someone else in the G20 before it's the U.S. So that I consider ourselves to be perhaps the best placed of the major Western economies. That shouldn't give me comfort that we could play this string forever. And it certainly doesn't tell me that we should be setting the example or somehow suggesting that modern monetary theory is a useful way to be conducting policy. So my own thinking, I would say, much the chagrin of some, probably hasn't evolved that much. The only thing I would say would probably be different from my thinking a couple of decades ago or a dozen years ago is because the central bank here in the U.S., as an example to the world, and many other buyers of certain assets like treasuries and agencies and the rest, because we are larger and larger parts of the market structure, it is possible to be repressing market signals, to be hiding price signals that we would otherwise be seeing. And when these policies are replicated by most of the other members of the G10 and G20, it's hard to know exactly what the equilibrium real rate would be. It's hard to know what R-star would be because we're all following these same policies. So I suppose the only thing that I've evolved in my thinking is that the Federal Reserve and other central banks, when we hang around these markets long enough, our ability to repress prices, our ability to set prices, is more powerful perhaps than I would have guessed a decade or two ago. And we're certainly running this experiment longer than I would have thought or hoped coming out of the last crisis.
One of the constraints that MMT does seem to acknowledge is an inflation constraint. The Fed has just finished this inflation review and love to get your take on what they're communicating post this review, how efficacious you think the new stance will be in terms of the market's judgment and what their ability to get inflation back to where they want it to be. How do you size it all up?
Well, let me try to do that quickly because there's a ton there, Dean. I'd say I believe that the remit that the Congress gave the Federal Reserve amended last on this point a few decades ago was price stability and maximum sustainable employment. As I both lived it and now observe it, I think the Fed has followed the congressional remit quite well. In the period between these two great wars, I think by the Fed's own measure, core inflation was running at around 1.6%. That sure sounds like price stability to me, Dean. I think mission accomplished. The miss against the Fed's interpretation of the price stability remit of 2.0%. I use the decimal point there really just for humor, but they take it seriously. The myth of inflation between what's actually transpired and the Fed's vaunted objective strikes me as relatively small. The definition of price stability I've long preferred is there a generalized change in prices that's interfering with household or business decision making? And 1.6% isn't doing anything of the sort. So I think that they've been very good stewards of the Fed's mission. And instead, I think they're concerned about a miss of 3 or 4 tenths of a percent, which relative to the other places where reforms are necessary at the Fed strikes me as relatively inconsequential. So in some sense, I think their best argument is that if we could get inflation up a few tenths, we'd have a little bit more interest rate room to cut. And so, listen, I do think it would have been useful if they had another 30 basis points to cut when this pandemic struck in 2020. But 30 basis points isn't monstrous. In fact, the Fed cut rates 75 basis points in 2019, more than twice the kind of incremental room they seem to be trying for now. And how much effect did the 75 basis points of interest rate cuts that were performed in 2019 have on the real economy that year? Something. If you could create or recreate 75 basis points in March, I suspect you would have had a much larger effect. So I don't believe at core that the miss is worth the risks that are being taken because of it. It doesn't bother me that inflation would run above 2% for a period of time. Again, it's in an overly simplistic way. It still feels like price stability to me. But I think in some sense, the miss on their inflation target is being employed to do a few other things. One, it's giving license to policymakers to cross the kinds of red lines we talked about before. And I don't think those red lines should have been easily crossed. After all, that's why they're red. But I understand why they were crossed in a crisis. But I think really what the Fed said in Jackson Hole was that the biggest mistake that's been made between these two wars, the 08 crisis and the 2020 crisis, the biggest error was that policy was too tight for a decade. And that's not what I think is the biggest opportunity missed. So it's a longer discussion, but I think they're early in interpreting and giving license to their new remit. It might turn out and none of us can know for sure, that we should be awfully humble about our ability to control and know what inflation is. I would have hoped that having given up a framework in this review that they culminated in Jackson Hole, where they, I think, quite rightfully cast aside this cruel choice, this Phillips curve choice, as if somehow there's a trade-off between inflation and unemployment. I think that's wonderful that that's been relegated importance, so an A-plus for that. But you would think now that they're fine-tuning inflation to move it up a few tenths, that they'd have a new theory of the case, that they'd have a new framework. And I suppose that's what I'm hoping we hear from them in the next period ahead, because it would, absent a new framework, absent having an empirical way of getting to their new objective, they might find that after a 35-year wave of disinflation, that the future doesn't look like the past at all, and we need to be awfully humble about the broad trajectory of prices going forward.
If you go back 10 years, right about this time in 2010, I think the debate was around QE2. There was a lot of discussion. The market was preparing for it. And if you looked at the funds rate, the target was zero, but the forward curves were considerably steep. Out 2 or 3 years, you had some yields with the expectation that this normalization process was going to occur. If you look now, the forward funds rate out a couple of years is basically right where it is. And that's the case with so many other developed market sovereigns as well. These are stuck at or around zero like the US, or oftentimes in negative territory, certainly Eurozone, even UK at this point. What does that tell us about the world's view of the future path of growth and inflation? What are the implications of how stuck these forward curves are and how flat they are out a couple of years?
So I don't think they tell us much in general about forward expectations of growth and inflation. I wish they would. I wish these prices were helping inform policymakers about what's around the corner, what's over the hill. But because of the participation of governments in these markets, which again, in dark times, I understand, I appreciate, and I think sometimes unavoidable, but because, I'd say, mistaken lessons learned from things like the taper tantrum, market participants see governments that are only moving in one direction in their participation in these markets. So markets, I think, are, instead of using these prices or being informed by these prices and telling us something about secular stagnation or growth or inflation, these prices are really telling you about the revealed preference of policymakers. And market participants now come to believe some version of that path dependency we talked about before, which is markets believe that the next move in policy by virtually every central bank everywhere in the world is towards still looser policy, and looser policy, still looser policy after that. So that's why, as we were having the debate back in my day between QE1, which was essential and important and innovative and necessary and useful in my judgment, when it came time for the debate over QE2 towards the end of 2010, my judgment then was that if we do QE2, there'll be QE347. And I'm afraid that's where we are. So again, my view is these extraordinary policy responses, perhaps in March of this year and in other periods, are essential and necessary. That's the job of the central bank. But in the times of peace, which we're still not in after this crisis, but in times of peace requires a more robust reform agenda, in part so that when the next shock happens, as it inevitably will, you're prepared to do everything you can to help the real economy. And maybe the way to end this and state it as simply as a wonky guy like you and wonky person like me can state it is the central bank's job isn't to minimize deviations of every move away from its inflation target or its growth target or its unemployment target. It's to practice policy so when the deviations are large, when there's a real shock, you can show up with overwhelming force, help the real economy get back to work, help businesses, households get back to work in a way such that you don't have prolonged periods of underemployment like we did after the last crisis, and I fear we will after this crisis.
Well, Kevin, you've given us a ton to think about today. Always appreciate the opportunity to engage you in discussions on markets and policy, and our listener base is definitely going to appreciate your insights. So thanks for taking the time today.
Hey, Dean, thanks very much, and I appreciate the questions. I should only end with one note, which is, having now endured these crises, you might think that an old, jaded policy like me would be negative on economic prospects. And listen, my view is I'd still rather have our problems than anyone else's, and the future in the U.S. is bright, but the point of this discussion is to say it's bright, but it's not inevitable. And so now as we've gotten farther from the darkest days of this crisis, it's incumbent upon policy leaders in Washington and businesses and financial market participants to start to ask questions about the robust reform agenda. So when the next shock happens, maybe it'll be a decade from now, maybe less, we're able to have policies that can restore this great engine of economic growth so that the 21st century is America's century, instead of being stuck in a world where we think our best days are behind us. I'm the optimist, even on dark periods like this.
I like ending on a forward-looking note of optimism, so thank you.
All right. Thanks, Dean. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.